Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. Coming up today, Jill Bevilacqua presents There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, with readings and reflections for the fifth Sunday in Ordinary Time. And our regular guest, Joan Lewis, takes a look behind the scenes at events here in the Vatican over the past 7 days. We begin today's programme then with the Gospel passage for the fifth Sunday in Ordinary Time, read to us by Sean Patrick Lovett.
As the crowd pressed in on Jesus to hear the word of God, he saw two boats moored by the side of the lake. The fishermen had disembarked and were washing their nets. He got into one of the boats, the one belonging to Simon, and asked him to pull out a short distance from the shore. Then, remaining seated, he continued to teach the crowds from the boat. When he'd finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out into deep water, and lower your nets for a catch." Simon answered, "Master, we have been hard at it all night long and have caught nothing. But if you say so, I will lower the nets." Upon doing this, they caught such a great number of fish that their nets were at the breaking point. They signaled to their mates in the other boats to come and help them. These came, and together they filled the two boats until they nearly sank. At the sight of this, Simon Peter fell at the knees of Jesus, saying, "Leave me, Lord, I am a sinful man." For indeed, amazement at the catch they had made seized them and all his shipmates, as well as James and John, Zebedee's sons, who were partners with Simon. Jesus said to Simon, "Do not be afraid. From now on, you will be catching men." With that, they brought their boats to land, left everything, and became his followers.
We've come to that most familiar of scenes, that most significant of gospel episodes, the miraculous draught of fish and the calling of the first disciples. Jesus is standing by the lake, the crowd pressing in on him. He sees two boats moored by the lakeside, and nearby are the fishermen washing their nets. In Mark and Matthew's Gospels, the calling of the first four disciples is presented differently. We're told that Peter and Andrew are casting their nets, when he calls them and tells them, "Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men." And they left their nets at once and followed him. And going on from there, we read, he sees the other two, James and John, with their father Zebedee, mending their nets. And at his call, they too follow him immediately, leaving nets, boat, father, with the men he employed, adds Mark. Neither Mark nor Matthew recount the miracle described by Luke in such detail. They concentrate on the call and the immediate response. No hesitation. They also use the plural when Jesus calls the disciples. "I will make you fishers of men." Mark, who was Peter's amanuensis, would have received from him only what Peter wanted recorded. And as one writer comments, Peter was not given to telling of miracles that involved himself. As for Matthew, the tax collector, a great haul of fish would not have impressed him in the same way as a miracle of healing. But for Luke, the figure of Peter stands out in this account. It is his boat that Jesus chooses to teach from. And throughout its centuries, the church has been referred to as Peter's boat, or more poetically, the bark of Peter, and represented as such by artists. The most famous of these was the so-called Navicella of Giotto, a mosaic showing the bark of St. Peter tossed among the waves and Christ walking in on the waters. It can still be seen today, or a fragment of it, scarcely distinguished among the shadows, writes Georgina Masson. Recovered from old St. Peter's when it was demolished in 1506, the mosaic was placed inside the porch over the central arch in the new basilica. Giotto made the mosaic in 1289, and we're told was paid 2,200 gold florins for his work. and it's said of Cardinal Baronius, disciple of St. Philip Neri, that whenever he passed this symbolic representation of Christ's church, he reverently uncovered his head. A charming legend is recounted by Irish poet Seamus Heaney. It regards the monastery of Clonmacnoise in County Offaly. Once the most celebrated religious foundation in the country, it's now only a melancholy ruin. But, writes Max Caulfield, well worth a visit.
Magnificently set in a sylvan bend of the Shannon, the longest natural waterway in the British Isles, this ancient walled monastic site is best approached by boat along the river from Athlone, so that its antique graves, early Christian buildings, round towers and high crosses rise majestically out of the morning mists that cloud in across the water.
And with that atmospheric introduction, let's listen now to the poem.
The annals say, when the monks of Clonmacnoise were all at prayers, inside the oratory a ship appeared above them in the air. The anchor dragged along behind so deep, it hooked itself into the altar rails, and then, as the big hull rocked to a standstill, a crewman shinned and grappled down the rope and struggled to release it, but in vain. This man can't bear our life here and will drown, the abbot said, unless we help him. So they did. The freed ship sailed, and the man climbed back out of the marvellous as he had known it.
The episode recounted in the Gospel probably took place in the neighbourhood of Capernaum, where Jesus had settled after he had left Nazareth. An ancient fishing town on the northwestern shore of the lake, it had also become Peter's town. He and his brother originally came from Bethsaida, another fishing town, as its name, which means house of fishing, implies. Although its exact site is not known, we read in the guidebook.
It is commonly accepted that Bethsaida was located on the northeastern shore of the Sea of Galilee, in the Beteka Valley, a marshy area where rivers coming down from the Golan Heights drain into the sea.
The people of Bethsaida, we know from the Gospels, didn't accept Jesus and his teachings, and together with Chorazin was cursed by him. Woe to thee, Bethsaida! For if the mighty works which were done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. So we read in Matthew. And the guidebook concludes.
It is thought that the curse was so powerful that Bethsaida completely disappeared from memory.
And what did Peter think, I wonder? The town of Mary Magdalene was also on the western shore of the lake and was, writes the guidebook, a fish products industrial centre, adding that its Greek name, Trakai, means the place for salting the fish. H.V. Morton, who writes that dyeing was the industry of Magdala, fills in the picture of the activities carried on in the lakeside area.
In the time of Jesus, the Sea of Galilee was one of the busiest centres of life in the country. The western shore was ringed with towns and villages, and the lake was crowded with ships. The trades carried on round the lake were boat building, dyeing at Magdala, pottery works and fish curing. The large curing factory was at Tarikaya, the pickling place to the south of the lake, where fish were salted and packed for export. There was always a big market for salt fish in Jerusalem. In Old Testament times, the fish trade seems to have been in the hands of the Tyrians and the Egyptians. The fish gate of ancient Jerusalem, round which the fish market was held, lay near the northern gate, the natural entrance from Tyre. It seems fairly certain, however, that about 50 years before the time of Christ, the Greeks broke this monopoly by introducing the fish-curing industry to the Sea of Galilee. Pliny says that in his time, the pickling place at Tarikaya gave its name to the whole lake, which suggests that the industry must have been at first a Greek enterprise. The trade must have expanded enormously, for we know that barrels of these cured fish were carried all over the Mediterranean world, and that enormous quantities were sent to Jerusalem every spring for the Passover crowds on pilgrimage to the temple.
And so, on that day in May, for so it apparently was, Jesus stood by the lake, which was still enveloped in the mists of early morning. There would have been plenty of noise, though, even at that time, from the shouts of fishermen who'd had a good catch and were on their way down to the curing sheds, to the hammers of the boat builders and the general hubbub and bustle of a busy place of this kind. Added to this, the throngs that would have accompanied Jesus from the moment it was known that he was in the vicinity. Jesus is speaking to them, but as the crowds increase and people push each other, as they do, in an effort to hear and see better, he finds himself more or less imprisoned on three sides. But then he spots the empty boats, moored nearby, and the fishermen, who are his friends. Indeed, also his disciples, though not yet totally committed. But that situation will be very soon rectified. Jesus steps into the boat of Simon Peter and asks him to pull out a bit from the shore. He then sits down in the boat and resumes his preaching. We're not told what he said to the crowds that day. It's what happened afterwards that Luke wants us to know. The first words quoted here are, "put out into deep water," or in that older, euphonious phrase, "launch out into the deep." One can almost hear the crunch of the pebbles and the rush of water as the boat slides out. Pope John Paul II has often quoted this phrase and once declared that the Lord's invitation was almost the motto of his apostolic letter, Novo Millennio Eneunte, at the beginning of the new millennium.
As the successor of Peter, I feel it my duty to echo these words of Christ to the whole church. Christ, who is the same yesterday and today and forever, urges every ecclesial community to put out into the deep, to go forward in hope into the new millennium, which opens before us like a vast ocean on which to venture.
And now, for the first time in the Gospels, we hear Peter's voice.
Master, we have laboured all the night and have taken nothing, but at thy word I will let down the net.
For Peter, expert fisherman, the command to put out into the deep water and lower the nets for a catch, when they'd been out all night labouring fruitlessly and had only just come ashore with nothing to show for their efforts, must have seemed like sheer madness, folly, against all reason. And Peter makes his point, brusquely if you like, sincerely, frankly, for that was his way. But he immediately adds words of faith in the master he has already accepted without reserves. Writes one scholar,
"The account of the miraculous haul of fish stresses Peter's obedience and his readiness with regard to Jesus. It also, however, shows how Peter's mission is founded only on the action of Jesus. Peter, in fact, knows he is a sinner."
Peter launches the boat into deep water, and he and his brother let down the nets.
"And when they had done this, they netted such a huge number of fish that their nets began to tear. So they signalled to their companions in the other boat to come and help them."
Lake Galilee is not particularly deep, and its waters are generally calm. But when the boats draw closer to shore and shallower water, there is a danger. H.V. Morton, our constant guide, explains.
The Galilean fisherman who nets a heavy catch is always anxious about the net, because the bottom of the lake is covered with sharp stones for perhaps 20 or 30 feet before the sand begins. What a shouting goes up as a heavy net is drawn out of the deep water towards the sharp stones. With what care the fishermen run thigh-deep into the lake to lift the precious burden clear of rocks.
The same writer, referring to the miracle St. John recounts after the resurrection, notes the concern of the evangelist for this same reason. Again they fish all night and catch nothing. And at daybreak, Jesus stands on the shore and tells them to cast on the right side of the boat. And when they do, they are not able to haul it in for the quantity of fish. 103 large fish, John notes. And yet, although there were so many, the net was not torn. The amount of detail in John's account our writer believes to be a conclusive proof that John was a Galilean and a fisherman. On that occasion, he was the only one who recognised the risen Jesus and told Peter, who pulled on his clothes and waded to the shore. But, writes John, the other disciples came in the boat, dragging the net full of fish, for they were not far from the land, but about 100 yards off. John actually uses the word cubits, equivalent to some 46 centimetres. So the boat was about 100 metres from the shore. A legend of Franciscan tradition relates that somewhere in the back streets of Jerusalem is the site of a house which belonged to Zebedee, father of St. John. This family apparently were fish merchants of Galilee, with a branch office in Jerusalem from which they used to supply, among others, the family of Caiaphas, the high priest. And this would explain the mysterious reference in John's Gospel to the fact that he, who refers to himself as that other disciple, was admitted to the house of the high priest after the arrest of Jesus, because he was known to the doorkeeper. Let's refresh our memory. Jesus has been arrested, taken first to Annas and now to Caiaphas. Writes John.
Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. As this disciple was known to the high priest, he entered the court of the high priest along with Jesus, while Peter stood outside at the door. So the other disciple, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to the maid who kept the door, and brought Peter in.
Well, it may be only a legend, but it throws a whole new light on that scene in the high priest's house in the early hours of that first Good Friday morning. And how otherwise, writes one, could the son of Zebedee from Galilee be known to the doorkeeper of the house of the most important man in Jerusalem? Legends aside, the miracle recounted in today's Gospel regards the action and reaction of Peter, the big fisherman, and the words of our Lord spoken in answer. Peter had seen other miracles performed by Jesus, water turned to wine, miracles of healing, which to us might seem more significant than a great haul of fish. But fish were Peter's life, and this was the miracle that impressed him most profoundly, as it did his companions. But why the sudden realization of sinfulness? Comments Sheed.
Precisely because the miracle hit home to him in all the reality of its miraculousness, he suddenly saw Christ for the first time. Seeing Christ, he at last saw himself.
But Jesus reassures Peter, who has withdrawn from him, physically and even spiritually, suddenly aware of the seemingly unsurmountable abyss which separates them. And then come those words which will change the life of Peter and that of his companions forever.
Fear not, from henceforth thou shalt catch men. And having brought their ships to land, leaving all things, they followed him.
And you can join Sean Patrick Lovett and Jill Bevilacqua at the same time next week for another edition of There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. Right now, our regular guest Joan Lewis is back to take a look behind the scenes at events here in the Vatican over the past 7 days.
It's been an interesting week, and because time is always our main concern in this show, we really have to choose pick and choose and do the foremost stories.
If we look at the main interest for our listeners over in England, in Great Britain this week, of course, it's been the visit of the bishops from England and Wales and the announcement that Pope Benedict is definitely making a trip to Great Britain later this year.
Right. It's like, you know, most of us knew that, but he just kind of confirmed that he would be going there, not that he laid out the specifics of the itinerary. But the bishops are here because, of course, every 5 years, every single bishop in the world, and they go as a conference, has to make what they call an and ad limina visit. But the visit by the bishops of England was very interesting. I mean, there were so many topics touched on other than the trip, when the Pope said he was looking forward to seeing the joyful faith of the people for himself. But he had some interesting words for the bishops. He said that it's very important for the church, just as he said a week earlier about Christian unity, to speak with one voice gives power and credence to the words that they are speaking.
Particularly in such a secular society as Britain today.
That's exactly it. And he said, he mentioned the secular society. He said for the full message of Christ to be presented to everybody in society and convincingly, the Catholic community needs to speak with a united voice. He also, he mentioned his visit. He talked about something I think you might know a little more than I do about it. He criticized something which I think in England is known as the Equality Act.
And it's a bill going through Parliament, legislation going through Parliament at the moment, talking about equality, and the bishops, not just the Catholic bishops, but in fact the Church of England and the other
right.
Christian leaders are all very concerned that this may leave them open to being sued, for example, if they're not willing to employ homosexual people in Catholic organizations. So there's a
right.
lot of concern around
Can
that.
We still be the Catholic Church and live up to our values? And the Church of England is saying the very same thing. And I think they were successful in kind of enabling the draft that had been proposed to be changed or something.
Exactly. It is very much a torturous process, and it's still going through the Houses of Parliament. But the bishops are certainly following it very closely.
I mean, the Pope himself stressed that, you know, we're the Catholic Church. We believe in and teach certain things, and we have to be allowed to be the Catholic Church and teach what we teach. So,
and not surprisingly, the press picked up on that.
Yes,
next day,
exactly.
The British papers were all reporting this particular sentence.
Oh, if you Googled the bishop's visit, the word Equality Act appeared in I think, you know, every single title. But these are important issues, and I think it's important. I'd like to mention to the listeners that I get emails every so often. How come the Pope doesn't speak out on XYZ person or thing in America, for example? And 9 times out of 10, the church has spoken out. They just haven't named that individual. How come a certain senator who says he's Catholic but actually he's pro-choice, why doesn't the Pope talk about him? That's not the Pope's job, to take a senator apart or a political party or something else like that. The Pope's job, the church's job, the bishop's job is to teach what the church believes in, the sanctity of life from the moment of conception to a natural death. Once you know that, and then if you know the senator XYZ or a minister doesn't follow that, then you should be able to put two and two together. But the church is not out there to berate individuals, to berate governments as a whole.
Also because as pastor of a universal church, he'd have his work cut out to follow what's going on in every single country of the world.
Exactly. 210 countries of varying sizes and everything else. So,
another interesting aspect of the Pope's speech to the English bishops was his words about Cardinal Newman, whose beatification, of course, he's widely expected to preside at during that visit to the UK.
Right. No, and he held Cardinal Newman up actually as an example, as he's done before, as an example for priests everywhere. And his fidelity to the church, obviously his suffering. So he held him up, as he's been doing with Jean-Marie Vianney, as a matter of fact, in this year for priests. So any model that the Holy Father can hold up in this year for priests, he does. So
another interesting character who he was talking about this week, of course, is St. Dominic. He came up at the Wednesday General Audience, didn't he?
That was wonderful. No, he did say it. The Pope focused on St. Francis last week, and he focused on St. Dominic this week. And he said Benedict said he has been talking about the renewal of the church, of course, in the Middle Ages. And he had powerful words to say. They were longer, seemed to me, longer than usual catecheses on these two saints. And they were giants in the church. And interestingly enough, he talked about St. Dominic when he was appointed a canon of the Cathedral of Osma. And I thought it was very interesting because what Benedict focused on that, he said, Dominic did not consider this a personal privilege, nor as the first step in a brilliant ecclesiastical career, rather as a service to be rendered with dedication and humility. And he said, do not, the Pope asked, do not career and power represent a temptation to which even those who have roles of leadership in the church are not immune. And he spoke about Dominic's many missions, obviously, throughout the world and said this is what we're all about. The church is a missionary church. We're an evangelizing church. So the fact that he traveled, especially, obviously, around Europe and realized, Dominic did, the need for good preachers. Because, and so, of course, the order, the Dominicans, which
today.
We call them, are the Order of Preachers, and which is why you see OP after their name as initials.
The previous day, of course, was the presentation of the Lord in the temple and the day dedicated to consecrated life, February the 2nd. And the Pope, as usual, had an important celebration of Vespers, didn't he?
Pope Benedict explained that this day of consecrated life actually has a triple aim. He said, first, to praise and thank the Lord for the gift of consecrated life, the people who have it and those of us who appreciate that gift they have. Secondly, to promote awareness and respect for consecrated life among the people of God. And lastly, to invite those who have fully dedicated their lives to the cause of the gospel to celebrate the marvels the Lord has worked in them. And I'd love to insert something a little profane in this talk of the sacred, because the Feast of the Presentation of the Lord, at least here in Vatican City, is normally the day in which the Christmas tree and the nativity scene are taken down in St. Peter's Square. So I had heard from a friend who's a total expert on St. Peter's Basilica and St. Peter's Square. He can name 140 saints on the colonnades. Alan told me that when they take down the Christmas tree, they give the ornaments to who's ever in the square who asks for them, right? So, of course, Joan's going to go over there now that she knows this on the Feast of the Presentation. Well, they said the second the tree would come down, the third. So I spent, you know, some time in the square on the third. And then finally they took the tree down. And this year, I suppose it's austerity budget. They're not giving the ornaments out to people. So
saving them for next year,
maybe,
recycling and reusing.
Right,
as
maybe
we
I'll
should.
Try and get one anyway. But so that is another event in Vatican City linked with the Feast of the Presentation of the Lord.
And I bet most of our listeners, as you say, didn't know that. Just time to look back even further to last Sunday's activities. The Pope gave a very important Angelus address, didn't he? Speaking both about
a number
the
of topics,
day
actually, right.
for the fight against leprosy, but also right. referring back to the Holy Land and a call for peace there.
It's called the day. It's actually only the second day of intercession for peace in the Holy Land, and so the Pope said that in communion with the Latin Patriarch, the Custos of the Holy Land, who is a Franciscan, of course, they've been there 800 years. He said, "I spiritually join the prayers of so many Christians all over the world and give a heartfelt greeting to those who have come here just for that occasion." And then he dedicated some remarks, because what the Pope does is he reflects on a topic or two before the actual Angelus, the Marian prayer, and then he will often reflect on another topic before greeting people in different languages. He also spoke of the economic crisis, which is causing the loss of so many jobs, and he said a situation that calls for a great sense of responsibility by everybody concerned, managers, workers, and politicians. And then he spoke of two specific Italian cases, and he said he's speaking for those in Italy and elsewhere who don't have work. And he echoed a call, however, made by the Italian Episcopal Conference that appealed for everything possible to be done to protect and increase employment, ensuring that people have jobs that are dignified and adequate to maintain a family. And, of course, this is just a microcosm, if you will, here in Italy, of a larger problem throughout the world of workers being let go, people not being hired or rehired, so you don't have the chance to live a dignified life because you don't even have an income,
okay,
for sure.
Okay, Joan, for the moment we're going to have to leave it there, but we'll speak to you again at the same time next week.
Okay.
Thank you for being with us.
Thanks there to our regular guest, Joan Lewis. And that's all we have time for on today's programme. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.